This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. As high school kids and their parents begin thinking about college, they have to consider a number of factors. Is it the right fit academically? Is it the right size? In the right location? And perhaps most importantly, does it have the right price tag? For more and more families, tuition is a deciding factor in where the kids will go to college, because the cost of a college education keeps increasing astronomically. A recent report from the College Board shows that during the last school year, the average tuition and fees at four-year public colleges rose 14% to nearly $4,700 on average. At four-year private colleges, where costs are already higher, the prices rose 6% to an average of nearly $20,000. A lot of educators, government officials, parents, and students are asking why tuition costs keep spiraling upward and if anything can be done to curb the trend. Today on Talk of the Nation, our guest says he knows what can be done, and we want to hear from you. Are you a parent or student about to write that check for the next semester? What changes do you think your college could make to keep costs down? If you're a college professor or administrator, we'd like to hear your views, too. You may not like everything you hear, and we pose the question, is education one of those things in life, like the arts or healthcare or police protection, that are too important to society to be subject to economic restrictions? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Richard Vedder is a professor of economics at Ohio University and author of a new book called Going Broke by Degree, Why College Costs Too Much. Professor Vedder joins us from member station WOUB in Athens, Ohio. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be with you, Lynn.
Professor Vedder, what in your opinion is the main reason that college costs are going up so high so rapidly?
Well, the underlying problem is that the productivity of the staff at universities has not been rising. It's been falling in the last generation or two. That is to say, whereas in most businesses, over time, with economic growth, we're able to do more with less, as it were, use fewer workers to produce a widget or whatever. That's not true in higher education. We actually use more staff, for example, to teach any given number of students than we did, say, a generation ago. And with a third party, such as governments and foundations and so forth, paying the bills for the average student, as tuition is raised by universities, the students are relatively insensitive to this, to the cost of this, not completely, but relatively so, because someone else is paying a good bit of the bills directly or indirectly through grants and student loans and tuition tax credits and so on.
Well, are you talking about are classes smaller and so you need more professors? What exactly are you talking about?
Well, it's just that if you just look at the number of staffs that a university has on the payroll, for any given size student, say you have a university of, say, 10,000 students, there are many more staff on the payroll today than there were, say, in 1990 or 1980 or 1970. And the main cost of running a university is its labor costs. It's workers. And increasingly, these are not teachers or instructors, but there are others. I think at Cornell University, Mr. Ehrenberg, I understand, may be on your program later on, in his book, he says that at Cornell in 1997, only one out of six employees was a faculty member. Five out of six were non-faculty. So and some of these people are doing good things. I'm not saying that. But increasingly, universities are not about teaching undergraduate students. They're about other things, and this is helping. This is contributing to the rising costs.
Other things such as?
Oh, research, of course, which is very important, but also a whole variety of things. Universities run dormitories. They run. They're in the food business. They're in the entertainment business. Some universities, mine included, spend millions of dollars a year subsidizing intercollegiate athletics, for example, which and those numbers are growing substantially over time.
And you also argue that, and you mentioned this earlier, that by getting grants or loans, even scholarships, that students become less sensitive to these tuition increases. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, yes. Let's say the tuition at a school is $5,000 a year at a public university, and the federal government decides, because people are concerned about tuition costs, to give a tuition tax credit, which they did a few years ago, and then they've liberalized it. Let's say they're going to give you a $1,000 tuition tax credit, meaning anyone who pays that tuition can deduct $1,000 against their income taxes. That gives an enormous incentive for universities to raise their tuition by $1,000, because the student or the student's parents aren't really going to feel the burden of that, because, in effect, a third party, in this case the federal government, is picking up the bill. And so we have a lot of that sort of thing going on, and it contributes to the increase of in the demand for education, the number of kids who want to go to school, but also the price of it, which in turn increases the budgets of universities enormously, which gives them a lot more money to go and spend on a variety of things, most of which is going for non-instructional purposes.
It seems like we have a sort of which comes first, the chicken or the egg situation here. I mean, aren't these kinds of programs like tuition tax credits intended to encourage to help people to go to college who can't afford, who may not otherwise be able to afford to?
Absolutely, and that's their purpose. And at the level of it, some individual student you want to pick, they certainly work in that direction. You ask a student, you're not from a wealthy family, yet you're at a school that has a tuition of $20,000-$25,000, they'll say, well, I have scholarships and grants and so forth that cover most of the costs. And so from their point of view, the $25,000 tuition is not an obstacle. And that's the way, in a sense, it should be. If we believe in equal educational opportunity as a nation, we want to provide help. That's the whole justification, or at least part of the justification, for government support of higher education. But it is true that as we very generously increase the amount of these payments over time, it allows the universities to raise their tuition charges more than it otherwise would. And so it's sort of a circular thing, a vicious circle. Costs go up in universities, so the government gives more financial aid to students, but that in turn allows the universities to raise their tuition still further. And there's no bottom line in education. How do you know whether Stanford had a good year last year or a bad year? It's very difficult to measure success in education, so we just tend to throw more and more money into it. There's relatively little accountability, even by governments, where you have state universities. They're largely independent of the governments. So we have tended to go on something of a spending spree at the university level, which is raising the costs ultimately to the students and to the taxpayers as well.
Well, you have a number of recommendations for how to increase productivity and cut down on costs. Maybe you could outline some of those recommendations for us.
Well, some things that universities themselves could do and may do in the future. Because as costs go up, you know, people are not totally insensitive to this, and some people are just moving away from the traditional universities. They're moving to for-profit schools like the University of Phoenix, or they're going to low-cost community colleges, which haven't had as much of a cost explosion, or they're going to Canada to school, or they're going online to school, what have you. So to deal with this loss of market share and some decline in state funding in the last few years, as state legislatures have become somewhat leery of increasing appropriations, universities are talking, and some of them are actually doing things like increasing teaching loads. The typical faculty member today teaches far less than the typical faculty member a generation or two ago. We're using technology more and more, or could use technology more and more to reduce costs, have students take courses online or using television and so forth, where you can lower the labor costs. We maybe can sell dormitories or at least contract them out to private operators who are in the business of food and lodging, no more about that than we university people do. There's a lot of things to do. Some people say we could even end tenure. I think that's a more controversial recommendation, but it's certainly one thing that imposes some costs on universities. We could cut down on a vast administrative bureaucracy that has grown up at most universities. Administrative staffs have soared at universities. The data are very clear on that. We could do a lot of things along those lines, and I think some universities are starting to do some of those things.
All right. We're talking about the soaring cost of college tuition and ways that universities could start looking more closely at their bottom line, perhaps. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Tom, and he's in Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that this trend is not unique to education. Healthcare costs have also jumped up once the government and the insurance companies started paying the bills. And what it has effectively done is it's removed the free market principles that would have otherwise kept the costs in check. There's always going to be enough students to... if they can't afford to pay for it themselves, then these third parties are going to pay the bill. And you just never see any university short of students. So there's no incentive to reduce the price. When I was at Stanford, the tuition was $6,000 a semester, and it was an open secret that 50% of the cost of the tuition was to pay for other people going to Stanford who couldn't afford to pay to go to Stanford. So it's a... It's almost a vicious cycle, as you indicated before. And I don't know if you noticed the USA Today article that was in the paper just last week or the week before, talking about all the scholarships and benefits and grants and loans have actually reduced the cost overall, but the actual tuition that people pay is higher, even though the percentage that they actually pay is lower than ever before.
Professor Vedder?
Yeah, the caller is right on the mark. The analogy that he drew between colleges and universities on the one hand and healthcare on the other is a perfect analogy, I think. The two biggest components of the consumer price index in terms of increases in the last quarter of a century are college tuition fees and healthcare costs, with incidentally college tuition fees rising the more of the two. Both of them are where third parties are increasingly involved in the business, if you want to consider education a business or healthcare. And everything he said is true. And I completely agree.
I'm just curious. You are a professor, a college professor yourself, and I'm just wondering what your own student, how many classes you teach. Do you think you could take on more students, more classes?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, I am semi-retired, but if I were teaching full-time, I teach in a university. I teach two courses each term. I usually have, if I'm teaching advanced classes, I sometimes have 40 students, but I have colleagues who will have 10 students or 8 students in advanced classes, and other professors at great research universities often teach just one course a term. Could I teach 3 courses a term instead of 2? Yes, I could. It is true there are trade-offs when you do these things. Part of it, you may do less research, and research is important. But some of the research that we do is just sort of mindless research in the quest for tenure, and we really get relatively little social benefit from it. I'm not saying this is true of all research, but it's true of some of it. So there are some issues involved anytime you want to change the system. But what is the primary purpose of universities? And I think most of the public would argue it is to educate to undergraduate and to some extent graduate students. That is the job one for universities.
We're talking with Professor Richard Vedder about what colleges can do to reduce their costs. When we come back from a short break, we'll hear another view, and we're still taking your calls at 800-989-TALK or send an email to totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the rising cost of attending college and ways those costs can be contained. Our guest is economics professor Richard Vedder of Ohio University. His new book is Going Broke by Degree, Why College Costs Too Much. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Ronald Ehrenberg, professor of economics and director of the Higher Education Research Institute at Cornell University. He's the author of Tuition Rising, Why College Costs So Much. Professor Ehrenberg joins us from studios on the Cornell campus in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lynn.
I think you've been listening to our conversation with Professor Vedder. First of all, what's your take on some of what you've heard?
Well, I think one unfortunate thing in Professor Vedder's presentation is that he doesn't distinguish between what's going on in private higher education and in public higher education. Public higher education in the United States has been hemorrhaging. The share of state budgets going to public higher education has declined over the last 30 years. State expenditures per full-time equivalent student have risen at rates barely higher than the rate of inflation. And the increases have not been sufficient to account for increases in things such as faculty salaries. And faculty salaries in public higher education have fallen relative to faculty salaries in private higher education. If you went back to 1980, the average faculty member at a public university earned about 90% of what the average faculty member at a private university earns. Today, the number is down near 77%. So the publics are having a great deal of difficulty attracting and retaining high-quality faculty. It's very, very difficult. You say, well, expenditures have gone up at the rate of inflation. Why isn't that enough? There have been tremendous costs that the publics and the privates have had to take on. Part of the reason for the cost comes from government itself, and here I agree with his analysis that there is room for less government regulation of the universities, but much of the increased administrative cost at my university is due to all of the money that we spend on environmental issues, on health and safety issues, on equal employment opportunity, on federal contract compliance, on auditing and reporting requirements. These universities have to come up with the money to completely wire their campus and capital construction costs, and the public universities don't have the access to as many private donors as the private universities have. And then over the last 20 years, the public universities have gotten involved in development and fundraising, and you have to spend money and hire people in order to raise money.
What about this whole question of productivity that
productivity issue is very interesting because we seem to be using a measure of the number of students that you can turn out per faculty member as a measure of productivity, and we're not talking at all about the quality of the product. You asked Professor Vedder what his teaching load is. I currently am teaching one course per semester because of some external funding I have. But in the one course that I'm teaching, I have 75 students, and they all write group research papers, and they meet with me regularly in my office. I have a number of other students doing research with me as part of the Cornell Higher Education Research Institute. And because of these experiences, many of these students are going on to PhD study. So I think one important thing that gets lost in the debate over productivity is the college experience for students, and what they expect today is very, very different than what it was 20 or 30 years ago.
And what about the idea of cutting non-educational programs, athletics, for example?
Well, I'm not going to be a defender of large athletic programs. I'm at the university, which is in one of the few conferences that have no athletic scholarships. But what students expect at a university and what universities have to do to attract students has gone up. And many public universities are finding that they need or they believe they need large athletic programs to build, to make their campuses more attractive to students, and also to build the type of alumni loyalty, which many of the privates already have, that leads to increased private support in the future.
Professor Vetter, there's something I wanted to talk to you about a little bit further, and then ask you, Professor Ehrenberg, to respond to it. And that is, your argument eventually sort of goes to privatizing colleges and universities, state colleges and universities. I wonder if you could just explain a little bit more about that idea.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think it's even politically feasible to truly fully privatize American universities at any time in the immediate future, and I'm not sure that I'm advocating it. But I raise the question in my book, why do we have public support of universities when universities are an investment for the individual attending school that in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases brings about a very significant increase in their income from what they otherwise would receive. College graduates earn close to, say, just rough it out, double what a high school graduates do on average. And so it's a pretty good investment going to college. That's one reason why the demand for higher education has gone up so much. Well, we've always assumed that there were a lot of external benefits to universities. Professor Ehrenberg in his book makes the point that universities promote economic development. Well, my own research shows, and I started out believing this myself, but when I start looking at the relationships between what we spend using public sector funds anyway on universities and what we get in terms of growth in income per person or what have you, we don't get those strong positive relationships, and we don't see that states that spend lots more money on public universities get significantly higher rates of educational participation, another goal that higher education, public support of higher education has. So I ask the question, maybe it's time to disengage somewhat from supporting universities. And indeed, that is what is happening, as Professor Ehrenberg indicates, at the state and local governmental level. They are reducing support relative certainly to their total budgets and in some cases relative to the number of students they have. So we're moving away from that. And I'm suggesting, well, maybe what we ought to be doing is giving more of the money directly to students, which we already do to some extent, and particularly to the lower income students, and largely disengage from education and let ultimately have state universities move closer to private status. Of course, they don't have the endowments and so forth that the Cornells of the world have. And so there are some problems with this, but at least I think it's an idea that is worth giving serious thought to.
Professor Ehrenberg?
Well, the growth of public higher education in the United States, which started actually at the turn of the 20th century, was a great democratization type move, which took higher education, which had historically been the venue just of the elites, and opened it up to the rest of society. And my concern is that over the last 30 years, we have not narrowed educational differentials by socioeconomic class, and the public higher education institutions have a unique responsibility to serve all members of our society, which the privates, although they should be doing that, do not always do. And the other point I would make is that we have shifted in over the last 10 or 15 years from thinking about higher education as a public good to thinking about higher education only in terms of the economic return to the people undertaking it. And if you accept the latter view, which is the view that Professor Vetter is putting forth, then certainly the standard economic argument is, well, just break down capital constraints and provide subsidies to individuals, and that's all you need to know. But I would sort of point out that the public higher education and the whole land-grant university system was developed with the notion that public higher education institutions have a unique responsibility to the rest of society and that they prove to serve the social purpose.
All right, I want to get a call in here now. Deb in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Deb. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling as a former adjunct part-time instructor at three colleges, but one public, one private, and one community college. And I just wanted to comment that if you're taking the money away from the schools, the government money, what ends up happening is you have a whole bunch of people like me with no insurance, no benefits. We work out of our car, or I had a bike. I couldn't even afford a car. And the students suffer. They don't get the education they want. I ended up going into the high school because I wanted to be able to have vacation, and if I got sick, I wanted to be able to see a doctor. When I ran into one of my former college students, he said, oh, yeah, we have a new athletic field, we have a new gym, and I can't get the classes I need. And he honestly said that to me because I asked him what was going on. I am saying it to push my point, but the fact of the matter is he said it. I didn't ask him.
All right, Deb, I want to read an email just to support what you said. Somebody wrote in something very similar, and I'd like to hear our guest reply. I work at a college, and I see what they are spending money on. Most of it is A, to enable new learning technologies, and B, do what students, parents, and alumni want, like athletics and student life. Mm-hmm. But in the library, which is the academic heart of most colleges, costs of journals, databases, and basic data, that is all information, have double-digit inflation every year. Over time, this is one reason college costs go up. So I'd like to hear you comment on that first, Professor Vedder. And thanks for your call, Deb.
Okay, I'll take it off.
Those are both interesting comments, and I don't disagree with either one. Indeed, the comment from Deb about her situation working at three different colleges points out another interesting thing. In the attempt to cut costs, a lot of universities are increasing the amount of non-tenure track, sort of adjunct faculty that are paid relatively modest amounts, have relatively little job security, and so forth. It's my sense, and this is partly just my intuitive sense more than based on factual information, is that there's a sort of an academic underclass of faculty that move from university to university. At the same time, we are at the other end of the spectrum, finding ourselves paying very large amounts for sort of superstar faculty, particularly at the better private universities.
And we actually have not discussed your take on tenure either, which is one of your cost-cutting proposals.
I'm not necessarily in favor of abolishing tenure, but I do think it does impose some costs on society. So anyway, you've got a huge disparity. I suspect a growing disparity. I don't know if Professor Ehrenberg agrees and knows more about this, between the haves and the have-nots within the academic community.
That's interesting. Let's take another call now from John, and he's calling from Idaho. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I go to the College of the Elberton College of Idaho in Caldwell, Idaho, and recently we actually lowered our tuition to about $13,000 a year, which cut our tuition in about half.
How'd you do it?
Well, what happened was that we had increased our sticker price just a few years earlier because of this perception of prestige, to make it look like we were more prestigious, because everyone was asking us, why is your college so cheap? Why is it so cheap to go there? Clearly you must not be as good as these other schools. But then what we did is we increased our price, and people said, oh, you are as good as those other schools now, with the perception, but we can't afford to go there anymore. So we just recently decreased it back down to the actual price. When we had the price up higher, only about 3 people actually ever paid the full price.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that the actual sticker price that the college was saying, this is our. There was a press release they released after they switched the price back down, and they switched it for those students too. But at the time, when our cost was about twice as much, only 3 students at the school were actually paying that price. Everyone else was paying very equivalent to what we've now lowered it to. But the problem was there was perception from students who would say, well, I can't go to your school because it's too expensive. But it really wasn't.
All right, that's an interesting comment, John. Thanks so much for your call, and I want to remind everyone that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Professor Ehrenberg, what's your reaction to that?
Well, can I return first to the previous caller who talked about the growth of part-time faculty?
Sure.
I think that Professor Vedder's point there was exactly correct, and the growth of part-time faculty and non-tenure-track faculty, which is being done in an attempt to hold costs down. My own research has shown that this leads to adverse outcomes for undergraduate students, and it reduces graduation rates exactly for some of the reasons that the caller mentioned. The other thing, of course, that is happening is that because of the poor treatment of adjunct faculty, there now is a growing movement in this country for unionization and collective bargaining for adjuncts. And as that occurs, the cost advantage from using them will go down, and universities will have to figure out other ways to hold their costs down.
All right. And to the point of the last caller, and either one of you can respond to this, perhaps Professor Vetter. I mean, it's a curious call in the sense that they just simply raised the tuition to be competitive and then dropped it back down again. I don't know how common that is, but it seems to it raises the question of, first of all, how much competition plays into this whole question.
Well,
of
if I could just
cost.
Answer that, because
go ahead,
I've
Professor
done
Arnberg.
Research on this. Colleges and universities fool around with what they call enrollment management or pricing consultants. And some institutions have found that when they reduce their price, their posted price to students, they can succeed in increasing revenue, as opposed to using the strategy of setting a high posted price but give large tuition discounts to many students. And that's what the caller described that happened at his institution.
Okay, let's see if we can get one more call in here. Craig in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hi.
Go ahead, Craig.
About the show. Yeah, I saw a report maybe a year ago talking about that some colleges were trying to cut costs by limiting contact time with students, whether it was shortening the school year or shortening the number of days that or hours that the kids met with professors per class. I'm wondering what the panel thinks about that, and I'll take my message off the air.
All right. Thanks so much, Craig. Professor Vetter, is that getting to some of what you're suggesting or not?
Well, I haven't heard much talk about that. There is, of course, a great growth in online instruction, both through the formal processes of through universities, traditional universities, and also through these for-profit providers, which were growing exponentially as we speak. So there is a view that the costs of higher education are largely labor costs, and if we can lower those costs, we can do better. But I, as a professor myself, and I've read what Professor Arnberg has said, and I think we probably largely would agree, there's a lot of students whose lives have been impacted by the personal contact that they have with individual faculty. And one raises some issues relating to quality if one starts dramatically cutting the class contact with faculty in an attempt to cut costs. There is a dilemma there. I'm not saying that some of it can't be done, but it's certainly not a totally costless thing in terms of qualitative issues as well.
Well, all of this is great food for thought, and I thank both of you for joining us today for this discussion. Richard Vetter is professor of economics at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Ronald Arnberg, professor of economics and director of the Higher Education Research Institute at Cornell University in Ithaca. When we come back from a short break, we take up one of the most serious political issues of the campaign, hair. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.